Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Sorry, I dialed in tonight and got knocked right back out again. Welcome to Renee's Heart to Heart. Tonight, we're going to talk about some very interesting facts that actually Shelley came across today. Somebody brought some stuff to her office, and she called me right away about it. And actually, the more I researched, the more I realize that there's a beginning of this that needs to be touched on first. There's an organization called CCHR.org. And what it is, it's a Citizens Commission on Human Rights. And what it actually talks about and what it actually fights against is the fact that so many people are given psychotropic drugs, Prozacs, Ritalins, there's so many numerous to name, sometimes at very, very young ages because of a diagnosis that I find out after researching today are not scientific. They are, they're just political. More than anything, they are designed by psychiatrists who are naming these mental disorders one by one. We started out with three, and we have grown to way into the hundreds. There's many books printed about all the different diagnoses that exist. And what was scary about a lot of this was the fact that there's no scientific conclusions that prove that somebody is, say, schizophrenic. Monitoring someone's behavior, and for instance, let's play a little game. You're a doctor, and somebody brings in someone to you, a young child, who slips into a, a not cognizant place and carries on a conversation with somebody who isn't in the room or answers questions that you don't hear. So a doctor who is educated, a psychiatrist who is educated, who has, some science and biology and all those things in his repertoire, makes the decision that this child must be suffering from dual personalities. But again, if you look through the history of psychiatry, there's no proof of that. There's no way to prove that somebody is actually struggling with dual personalities. One of my favorite all-time movies with Sally Fields was Sybil. And they made the movie so that you understood why Sybil had to escape and put herself in another place and became all these different myriad of personalities, somebody who's childlike, somebody who's strong, somebody, boys and girls alike. The movie was great because you could actually imagine how many times in your own head, if something was going on, especially when you were a child and you have a vivid imagination, where you could take yourself someplace where you could deal with what was going on in your life. So example of schizophrenia, I think, especially if you watched it when you were very young and not tainted by age, you could believe it. But the research I did today tells me that there is no honest-to-goodness basis of proof. And according to the deeper I read on this site was the fact that psychiatry back in the day were looking for recognition. And in order to get government-funded hospitals and places like that, which we've talked about before on the show, a lot of the insane asylums that functioned back in the day, they would put any number of people in and put them on all kinds of drugs that altered their personality, truly altered their personality. And, of course, now the biggest thing is ADHD and things like that, where they start giving kids different drugs to help level them out, put them in a place where they make better decisions and are more alert and more focused, etc. And I've had many mothers, by the way, tell me that their children do better on the drugs than without them. So, again, that could be, or it could be mind over matter. But the fact of the matter is that there's no scientific proof. Shelley has joined us. I'm going to bring her in. This was a topic that she really wanted to talk about, so I'm going to bring her in so she can talk. Hi, Shell.
Hey, Rain. How you doing?
So I'm good, honey. I did a lot of reading this afternoon, and I dug up a lot more stuff than I had any idea I was going to. It's quite an interesting site, and one of the many articles that I read. There's kind of a beginning though that we need to establish before we can really talk about the use of the psychotropic drugs and what that has caused. I mean, there's sections in this website that talk about the Holocaust being being a part of a drug-induced rage and anger. And, of course, before all of that started, there was eugenics, and that was the perfect person, the perfect child, the perfect adult, and they were actually going through, mostly in Germany, but I imagine there were other areas that practiced this, but the records were kept in Germany of how many places where they put young kids, babies, to death because of them being, as far as they were concerned, genetically unsound. Too short, curly hair, dark skin, whatever the case was, there were hundreds of these places that were called mental institutes, and they were really a place to just put these children to sleep. And some of these stories are horrific. I mean, really horrific. But let me real quick read what this says about the city's Commission on Human Rights. The Citizens Commission on Human Rights International is a nonprofit organization whose stated mission is to eradicate abuses committed under the guise of mental health and enact patient and consumer protections. It has been described by critics as a Scientology front group that campaigns against psychiatry and psychiatrists. It was established in 1969 by the Church of Scientology, can you say that word, and psychiatrist Thomas Szasz, and is headquartered in Los Angeles, California. Now, again, when we read some of the stuff that I read, I look it up on Google, and I expect people to, like I do, judge it accordingly. This is somebody else's thoughts on what's going on. I want to make that clear to everybody, and it's up to the rest of us to analyze whether or not we believe this or that. So some of the other notes, though, that I went through. Little things like, well, of course, the eugenics, which was horrible, and of course that's one of the biggest reasons for the Holocaust. And they talked about way back then, this was like in the 40s, 400,000 people in one area were sterilized because they didn't want them reproducing. Then
wow.
Even more were killed, and most of them were children. And this was, well, on this site, they call it like a deck of cards.
Uh-huh.
Pick a card, and you get to choose what we're going to call this. And they also claim that the diagnosis for a lot of these things are theoretical, you know, without any scientific basis, without any testing, without any surveys, without any, I mean, you can't open up a brain even today, and this is many, many years later, and examine the brain and figure out why Renee was who Renee was.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
there really is no way that I know of. Of course, I'm not a scientist, nor am I a psychiatrist, nor am I a doctor. But it seems to me if you look at tissue and you look at blood, you can find out a lot of things about a person. But you really can't find out a lot about their personality, I don't think, not at this point in time. You can see in some of the information that I've read, not tonight but previously, brain scans and stuff like this will show disconnects. They will show strange parts in the brain. Remember the night that I'd watched that special on TV where they showed people who touched the hand of somebody that they knew loved them, and some of the anger and fear and everything would disappear from their brain scan.
Right.
So we do know that we have those kind of capabilities, but again, those are reactions. Those are not. A reaction is different. Go ahead.
Well, the bottom line is, and people sort of know this, but they don't really. It's not something that they think about, but the mind and the brain are two different things. The brain is
right.
The organ, it's the computer in our body, basically, and the mind is the functioning emotional and thought processes that make each one of us unique. That's our personality that uses the brain. So our minds use the brain to function, to retrieve information, to store information. And that's why analyzing the physical organ is not going to reveal a lot about somebody's personality. It's because it's basically a computer. That's what the brain is. The mind is something that is outside the brain and that uses it. And, you know, and this isn't getting into, like, you know, like religious nonsense and that kind of stuff, but I mean, very credible laboratories and universities and scientific research have proven that there is an energetic field around the body, whether, you know, there's a lot of different names for it, all right, but the bottom line is the brain is the organ, but the mind is what is unique from person to person and uses the brain in order to function and, like I said, store and retrieve knowledge and things like that. So that's why just examining the brain itself is not going to really reveal a lot. And it's also why a lot of these drugs cause just wild side effects, because you're not taking into consideration the other things that are affecting why the brain is acting the way it is or why it's malfunctioning. And a lot of time it's organic, and it can be dealt with through diet and other types of means without resorting to drugs.
Well, I do think there's some scientific proof in regard to the reactions we have to food, to words, to body language.
Mm-hmm.
And a touch, all of those kind of things are recorded and studied. The thing that this organization is talking about is how they just come up with all these names. For instance, for many, many years, homosexuality was a mental illness.
Exactly.
If you were a homosexual, you were mentally ill. There was something wrong with you. And remember the night we talked about the insane asylums, and one of the reasons women in their 30s often, who could not recover from the death of a child, were institutionalized, and sometimes for the rest of their lives.
I know.
And, for me, that's but it's archaic, so you give it to that. You say to yourself, you know, this is back when, you know, people thought a lot of foolish things, because so many things, as our world grew, so many new things and so many things happening all the time, and as we multiplied, I imagine, knowing today the variety of people and the fact that we talk all the time about how different we all are and that there's so many of us and our differences are uncountable. Somebody could even figure that out when you came to figuring out, well, let's see, if we have this many million people, how many different personalities would there be? There would be this many million personalities. That's what there would be. And that doesn't make one person sane and the other one cuckoo. That makes one different from the other one. So some of the other things, the search for acceptance is a big thing, for psychiatry to be accepted into the world of science. And they just continued to invent names for different maladies on a constant basis until they came up with hundreds. And in the 70s, they voted. They didn't do more testing. They didn't analyze more subjects. They sat down at a table and voted on whether or not homosexuality should be a mental illness or not, with a vote.
Wow. Yeah.
So if they can vote on that, I mean, I'm glad they did, don't get me wrong, for whatever the reasons that they thought to do that. But isn't that kind of like rolling a dice?
Well, of course it is. And that's one of the issues I have with psychiatry. I that I'm very critical of it, because I think in many times psychiatry is not, well, first of all, it's too based on pharmaceutical medication. Instead of looking at why a person is having the issues they're having, it's like most of Western medicine, it deals with the symptom. So if you have somebody that's showing anger, they're going to give them something to calm them down. If somebody's depressed, they're trying to give them an antidepressant. Meanwhile, antidepressants have such nasty side effects that one of the side effects of antidepressants is that the person becomes more depressed. So I've still never been able to really wrap my brain around that. But psychiatry and psychotherapy are very, very different. Psychiatry does not look at the whole person, and I think that's probably the reason why I have such an issue with the field of psychiatry. Because they're dissecting the emotional or mental behavior of somebody from the rest of the organism, and you can't do that, because the derivation of this person's personality flaw, or whatever is being perceived of as a personality flaw, could have so many roots in something physical, in some trauma, in so many different things, and they don't look at the big picture. They just medicate to cover up the symptoms without ever dealing with what created that particular personality challenge to begin with. And, you know, that never fixes the underlying problem. So now you've got a person that's got to be on medication for the rest of their life just to, and not even to feel good, but just to be able to function on some basic level. It doesn't even really return them to a really, really good life. You know, there are random stories where somebody really responded well. But the unfortunate part of that is the exception to the rule. the most people have very, very bad side effects. So for the few that are helped, the many aren't. And that's why I have an issue with psychiatry.
Well, I mean, I think there is certainly a place for psychiatry and psychiatrists. And yes, I believe mental illness is a true diagnosis. What I don't believe, when I think mentally ill, I think of somebody who cannot deal with life. I think of somebody who is just not an incredibly strong person. But if you give that person some kind of mellowing, or, well, it doesn't even really mellow them. It kind of like, I don't know. In my experience, what it does is make them less hyper. So I guess there is a mellowing effect. And it does make them less inquisitive and more subdued. Not really mellow, but subdued, I guess, is a better word. So then what you're really doing in a lot of cases is you're taking away the imagination of a young child.
Exactly.
And their imagination is wondrous. I mean, I tell stories about AJ all the time, but I could go way back to my own kids or my brothers and sisters. And the things that we would talk about and the things we could make up and the things that we would dream about and everything, that's a part of the beauty of life. Let me read this because I think that this is really important for this. The CCHR continued to lobby for legislative reform on mental health issues such as the keeping of a detailed computer with records of involuntary committed patients and their family. Now, that means somebody who was taken against their will, and drug experimentation without patient's consent. Now, obviously, there was a lot of that. The CCHR would typically request a tour of the psychiatric hospital, issue a public report based on patient testimony and other sources, and then push for legal investigations and reform. Its early focus was on involuntary commitment procedures. In other words, taking somebody against their will because somebody else didn't think they were behaving the way they thought they should behave. Since then, the group has organized media campaigns against various psychiatrists, psychiatric organizations, and pharmaceutical companies, including Eli Lilly. That's a big pharmaceutical company. Lilly is big, big, big. The manufacturer of Prozac. One campaign is said to have caused a major fall in sales of Prozac, causing considerable commercial damage to the company. Well, I don't care about that. I mean, that's I guess part of me thinks that should happen, but that wouldn't be my driving force. The group campaigned against the use of Ritalin for the treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. That's ADHD, which they have diagnosed in the thousands to millions of young children since they came up with Ritalin. A disorder which this particular organization dismisses as non-existent. The campaign was part of the Ritalin class action lawsuits against Novartis, that's the manufacturer of Ritalin, CHAD, and the American Psychiatric Association. All five lawsuits were dismissed in 2002. In 2003, CCHR presented a report with the title The Silent Death of America's Children to the New Freedom Commission on Mental Health, with case histories of several dozen underaged psychiatric patients who had died as a result of psychotropic drug treatment and restraint measures in the 1990s and the early 2000s. Now, people, that was a very short time ago. We're not talking about the 20s, 30s, and 40s anymore. We're talking about when the decade when most of my grandchildren were born is what we're talking about. In 2004, CCHR sponsored a bill requiring doctors to provide patients with information about the medication side effects before prescribing any psychotropic drugs, while also mandating a legal guardian's signature. Opponents of the bill argued that these additional procedures might discriminate against mentally ill patients while delaying treatment. The bill attracted widespread disagreement in the medical establishment, including the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health, who opposed it on the grounds that it compromised informed consent. Who opposed it on the grounds that it compromised informed consent. So that means if somebody agrees to it, it still takes a long time for them to get it because of all these rules. The Massachusetts
Right.
Psychiatric Society also opposed the bill, believing that it would interfere with the doctor-patient relationship. So there's a lot on this site and the different menus you can click into in regards to how this particular committee, CCHR, has fought to stop so much of this being handed out. Now, you remember a couple months ago, we did a show about the pill mills. We
Yep.
did a show about how many doctors you'd go in. Oh, my God, my back is just killing me. It doesn't matter what I do. I go to a chiropractor. I can't stand it. Okay, well, let me write you a prescription for oxycodone. They're really good. They're time release. They were invented for cancer patients. But if you're in such severe pain, let me give you these. First prescription that's filled, that person is hooked on heroin.
That's right.
And getting off that particular drug is no easy feat. And
right.
I know from personal experience, while you're on that drug, you are in such a state of relaxation, you are like a Raggedy Ann or Raggedy Andy doll. Does anybody out there who's had severe back pain know what it is to do that kind of motion, lose your ability to keep your body straight, keep everything moving the way it's supposed to be moving? What happens to the back pain then? You cause more damage. It becomes more
right.
excruciating. So then when you're getting low on those lovely oxycontins or oxycodones, where are you? You're back at the pill mill. Now imagine a young mom with five kids. Not hard to imagine, even by today's standards. A lot of families are large again. So you have five kids, and four of them, just everyday kids. They go to school every day. They got B's, maybe a couple C's, couple A's. They're doing all right in school. You don't get reports that they're not paying attention. They get along with a whole bunch of different friends. You got one kid who struggles with almost everything. So you go to the pediatrician and you say to the pediatrician, you know, I don't know what's the matter with Rainey. She just, you know, she's not like her brothers and sisters. She seems to be like in a world all of her own, and she's not doing well in school. The teachers tell me she doesn't try to participate. She's capable because they've tested her, but she's not trying hard enough. Now, how many times? Well, you're not a mom, Shell, but you have a sister and you have nieces and nephews. That
right.
scenario probably gets played out in living rooms all over the world a million times a year.
Of course it does. Of course it does.
Right? So
right.
now, if you're in the wrong place, somebody's going to stand up and say, and sometimes it's a teacher. Often it's a teacher. Matter of fact, on this site, they talk about how many teachers have gotten in trouble for being the extenuating circumstance in the death of a child because they insisted that the child be on Ritalin or whatever they're giving them to settle them down, or they won't be
right.
allowed to come back to school. So
right.
everybody interferes with Rini's bringing up and says, you know, she's got to be on something because obviously she's in trouble. She's mentally ill. You know, she needs some extra help. So we'll give it to her in pill form. Instead of seeing what kind of food she might be allergic to, instead of seeing if she has a hidden problem, if maybe somebody's hurt her and you don't know about it, instead of checking any of those things out, you immediately shove a pill down her throat that she becomes addicted to, because it does enhance some things and probably gives her a very, very slight letting go or euphoria or something. It adds something that she didn't have before, so she becomes addicted to it. For the rest of her life, and you and I met people like this at Hippocrates who started out on Ritalin at age 5, and by the time they were 21, they were hooked on something.
That's right.
Couldn't live without Prozac, couldn't live without Xanax, couldn't live without this, couldn't live without, because I get too anxious. You don't understand, I get too anxious.
But they don't like the way they feel on or off the drug either. That's the sad thing about it, is that now they're living a lifetime where they're always in a holding pattern, because the drugs don't actually make them feel good. It just makes them feel like they can cope. But mm-hmm. even on the drugs, they don't feel quite okay. You know what I'm saying? So it's kind of a tragedy when you look at the big picture of that, because these people, it's not a normal way to function. And most of them don't even know what it is to have a mind and a sense of control about their lives that has some level of normalcy to it. It's always it's created for them in a pill. And if they miss a dose, and sometimes it's just psychological because they're aware they missed the dose, then they're losing all sense of being able to handle the day, and things just overwhelm them so easily. I mean, you and I saw some of the people react to what you and I would consider kind of silly, and it just ruined their day. They completely lose the ability to put things in perspective, and they lose the ability to just cope with normal stuff that happens day to day. You know, stuff that really isn't that big of a deal, but to them, it's huge. It's monumental, because their brains don't function in a way that perceives things in an appropriate way. And a lot of that is brought around by drugs like Ritalin and stuff like that. So on one hand, it calms them down, and on another hand, it overemphasizes things that other people wouldn't even have an issue with. So there's any kind of a lopsided reaction out of it.
Well, and you because we are all so different, and because doctors and psychiatrists and even social workers, people that dedicate their lives to helping other people, they are just people as well. And very often they are suffering from many different kinds of, I don't like to call them disorders because I don't think there's any set order. So in order for there to be a disorder, there'd have to be a set order. So it's more like just being different and seeing things differently. And I think that that's a part of life. But one of the things that upsets me more than anything is that when you take the edge off of some of us, you take away a lot of our quality of life, because the edge sometimes is what helps us cut through everything. That edge is very important to us. And yes, sometimes it's a little bit more difficult to handle because sometimes it gets overwhelming. But the fact of the matter is, if you take away our edge, take away our imagination, take away our happiness versus our sadness. If you are never really sad, you don't know when you're happy or not, do you?
That's right. There's no normal progression of emotion through different facets of life. It's like they're always in this like bland state. So, like you said, so if you're not having the normal ups and downs, then okay, so maybe you don't want to feel sad or depressed, but that means you're not feeling elated or excited either. It's your life becomes just bland, you know.
Well, and it gives you, you know, what do you look forward to, Shell? When you're having kind of a crappy week, say, you know, things aren't going the way you want them to go and the car's running funky and you just found out that something's wrong with the AC at home and you walk into work and somebody looks at you like, you know, you've got two heads and you don't know what you did to them and you got to deal with that. So you're having that kind of a crappy week. What do you look forward to make sure that you can, first of all, have that something to look forward to so that it kind of like dangles in front of you to pull you through the mess you're in right now, right? If you can get that picture, right? You're standing in the middle of quicksand and it feels like it's swallowing you and there's somebody with a rope and you look at them and you know that once you reach your hand out and pull yourself up to them, things are going to be better. What is that something that you look forward to that will get you through those times?
Oh, there's a number of things. I mean, spending some time with my family or going out to the beach or listening to music sometimes does it for me. Mm-hmm. Depending on what the slump is, I have several things that I can look forward to that would then put me in a better place. So,
right. That's what has to be taught to these people. That's the lesson that all of us need to learn. I just gave this sermon to somebody very close to me today. They're in the dumps, and they're feeling, you know, like they're carrying most of the load, and indeed they probably are, but that's a part of life too. Sometimes you're the carrier, and sometimes you're the carried. That's the way it goes. So I said, you know, do you like to write? And I said, so, okay, if that's not something you like to do, how about music? Love music. I said, get in your car. It's hot as hell outside. Turn on the AC. Put on your favorite music and just drive.
Right.
And I guarantee you when you come back, you're going to be in a better place. Instead of popping a pill or taking three or four shots of booze or whatever, or smoking a joint or whatever you use to bring yourself back, use something that doesn't impair you while you're doing it.
You know, any time that you, well, first of all, music is powerful. You and I have talked about that before. Music can just take us places, you know, whether you're listening to something very soothing or new agey or rock and roll or you know, whatever it is that touches you and that makes you feel better, you know. But the other thing is being around nature. I mean, one of the things very powerful is the beach because of the ionized air that's out there. There's something very special about the beach, whether it's daytime or nighttime, but walking on the sand, you know, kicking your shoes off, really, really getting connected to the earth, smelling the air, listening to the sound. If you just close your eyes and listen to the sound of the water, the whole experience is actually very therapeutic. Or to walk through a heavily wooded area and look up. I do this sometimes, and it always surprises me because, you know, they say, you know, when you want to uplift yourself, and it's just kind of ironic that when you look up, the action of looking up is actually uplifting to us emotionally. And I used to lecture
about
this. Yeah,
that's right. I know that's true. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like walk outside. You know, walk in nature. Get in your car, drive to the beach. If you know there's a wooded area or a park near you, but look up. Look up at the sky. Look up into the trees. And there's just, you know, we're connected to this earth. It's symbiotic if you take advantage of it that way. You know, and when you look into nature, look into bodies of water, look at trees, look at beautiful scenery, it can really uplift you, but people have to be open and look to do that. If you're driving to work or you're walking around and your head's hanging down, you know, again, it's so odd that the terms we use actually describe our posture. But when you're feeling down, what's happening to you? Your shoulders are slumped forward, you're staring down at your knees, you know, and you feel crappy. But if you were to just change your posture a little bit, even force it. Throw your shoulders back a little bit, pick your head up, kind of look up, you know, look into the sky or look forward to something, it might be a very, very, very slight change, but if you keep doing that and if it's a conscious effort, you will ever so slightly keep improving your emotional state. And if people could get in the habit of kind of, you know, like contouring this and just taking control of how they feel, unless they have something clinically wrong or they've had a trauma. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be that simple. But I'm just talking about normal, just being in a funk. You're having, like you said, you're having a rough week. There are ways to lift yourself out of that where you don't need to go and pop a pill.
That's it. Well, and like you say, it's all about being able to know when you're really in the dumps. A good friend of ours who for many years was one of our teachers and therapists at Hippocrates, he ran the morning exercise and meditation. And his favorite thing, and half of the graduates would stand up there and do it and repeat it because they got it. And that would be to stand up straight and tall, bend your knees just a little bit, and smile.
Yep.
And it would start people's, something so simple would start
mm-hmm.
people's day with just a whole different air to it. And it is about you. But part of the conversation tonight is about young people and people that are not making the decisions for themselves. The young person that's in kindergarten or first grade and is already struggling with school, and teacher calls mom in and says to mom, "You got to get something because this kid can't be in my class. He disrupts the class all the time." These are some of the people that need people like us to stand up for them, because that's
right.
Not right.
That's right.
If that is indeed where you have to go, and it's possible, I'm not saying that you would never need medication. I don't know that, so I'm not going to say that. But I will say that should be the second, third, or fourth choice, not the first choice.
Right.
So if you have a child that is struggling, and you see them struggling, and school is giving you a hard time because they disrupt the class or because they're not behaving the way that particular teacher thinks they need to behave, there's many things you can do before you make a decision, like putting them on something that is going to eventually be more harm than good for them. And
mm-hmm.
we've talked about food. We've talked about how you handle them, talk to them, treat them. That's your responsibility as well. And find out if that teacher likes your kid. Because that teacher
That's
might
right.
not like your kid. It's not that far-fetched. First time I found out somebody didn't like my Mikey, I was devastated. And I think I've told this story before. I thought, my God, she just doesn't really like him. And that's what he thought. And when I went to school and confronted her, I mean, I left her in tears because she had no idea that she was doing that to him. Once we cleared the air, it was good again. It was fine. And he ended up being one of her favorite students, and she ended up being one of his favorite teachers. So there's many things you can examine before you go to something that should be the last resort, not the first resort.
And we've talked about it before that, again, you know, there's no absolutes in anything, but the bottom line is that when you're talking about a child that is clinically in need of pharmaceuticals to put them in a good place, you're talking about the exception to the rule, not the masses.
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
overdiagnosis of ADHD, the overuse of Ritalin, is, as far as I'm concerned, criminal. I mean, this is my opinion, all right? But I believe mm-hmm. that it's being pushed by the pharmaceutical companies for profit to pacify the upcoming generation so that they have lifetime customers. And this is a lot of, I mean, when you read things about Codex and all this other nonsense with the pharmaceutical companies, but they really aren't out to cure people. They're out to create, you know, lifetime customers, lifetime consumers.
That's right.
But they, when you look at it, because I think of my cousin when I was growing up, he was, they tried to institutionalize him at one point. He was always in trouble in school. He had to go to a special school at one point. And he lived a miserable, miserable childhood. And they found out when he became an adult that he had food allergies. So he wasn't disruptive because he was a bad kid. He was disruptive because his blood sugar was all over the map. And they didn't find out until he was in his 20s. And once they did and he got his diet under control, as an adult, he lived a very, very normal, controlled life. But he had all these emotional scars about how he was treated as a child. And then I shared on the air that one night about my nephew, who also was having behavioral problems when he was a little guy. I think he was 7 or 8 years old. So, you know, he was in the first or second grade, I guess that is. But anyway, but he was a little guy. And but he was very unruly at school. And my sister was seeing a pediatrician that was very enlightened. Probably one of the very, very few at that time, because we're going back about 28, 29 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he had my sister put him on what was called a clean diet. And there were really no pediatricians around there that did this, so my sister really lucked out. And he had to put her on a clean diet, and within a week, on taking sugar out of his diet, processed food, dye, things like that, he was like perfect. He didn't argue with the teacher anymore. He was able to sit and concentrate in class, you know. And then one night, my brother-in-law came home, was pissed off because he thought it was ridiculous that the kid couldn't have a Twinkie. He says, this is inhumane to make him eat this way, and blah, blah, blah. So he comes home and gives my nephew a Twinkie just to prove a point to my sister. And literally within 10 minutes of eating the Twinkie, this poor kid was out of his mind. He was in the hallway. He was banging his head on the wall. He said, what's wrong with me? I feel like I'm coming apart. And he banged his head on the wall so much he actually made his forehead bleed because the sugar made him angry, made him sad. Any sugar in his body affected him emotionally. And there are so many kids that everything you buy today for kids has got sugar in it. Have you ever read the ingredients? So,
oh, yeah.
So there's more, all the packaged products that people buy, unless you buy in like Whole Foods and you read the package and it says no sugar or low sugar or maybe it's got something natural in it like stevia or something like that, they cause these spikes in children's emotions and now they're acting up because they're eating a diet that isn't really that healthy for them. And now instead of changing the diet, let's leave them on that diet that keeps them strung out all the time. So now let's give them Ritalin to keep them under control, and you're just compounding the problem because you're not going to what the root cause is. You're pacifying the situation and controlling a symptom instead of correcting what was causing the symptom. And
right. It's like you're putting on a dirty Band-Aid. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And the worst shame of it is, like we have said already, is that you're setting a habit into play, a habit that is kind of uncontrollable and in many cases irreversible. So it's something that you want to pay close attention to before you make a decision like that. I also think that in a lot of cases, I don't know how serious everybody takes when you're going to go see any doctor. Everybody, if you say to somebody, you know, I got this going on, and I'll use myself. I bad back. I've been to a chiropractor. I was really in pain. I ended up falling down some stairs where I worked, and it got so bad that I had to keep a towel under me when I slept at night because otherwise I couldn't turn. It was awful. If you bumped me when I was walking, I would just burst into tears. I mean, it was relentless, painful, miserable. So I went to a doctor. which I had done many times before, and they always wanted to have me do exercise and all this other kind of stuff, which I would do, and it would make me a little bit better, but it didn't really fix the problem. And
right.
Hand me Percocet or Darvon or Darvocet, or one doctor wanted to give me Percocet and Valium, and I said, wait a minute. I said, I work 60 hours a week. I have four kids, teenagers. I said, I have to know what I'm doing. I can't take all that stuff. And as I've announced on many occasions, I get real stupid on several Miller Lights, so I never did real good on any kind of drug. So,
yeah, I can vouch for that, people.
Yes, I'm sure you can. And so I just couldn't do that. So I went to a doctor. I really liked him. He was really nice to me, and he made me feel good about it. And I went home and I told everybody I was going to have back surgery. And I had several friends who were older than myself and came to me and said, "Are you crazy? How many opinions did you get about this?" So they made me question myself. So as I found out, as I went through the journey to have back surgery, they do send you to many other doctors. And one's to check your heart, one's to check your blood. Like I've talked about before, you get a gambit of doctors for one surgery to make sure that everything else is functioning good enough for you to be sedated for any length of time and to withstand a surgery. So I did all that. Every doctor that I went to see, I said, "Do you think I should have back surgery?" Showed them my MRI, and they said, absolutely, you have to have back surgery. You're not going to be able to walk in 6 months if you don't have back surgery. Okay. So then I make a decision. I tell the doctor, yes, we're going to do it. And I tell my friends, I've got to take off work. I've got to have this back surgery and everything. Well, are you sure you know what you're doing? I have three girlfriends who had back surgery, and none of them can walk now. They're damaged for life. They have dead nerves in their legs, and they have no feeling in their feet. And I'm like, you know what? I can't listen to all of this. I have to make a decision that's right for Rini. I cannot live on painkillers. I have too much to do.
Right.
I cannot live like this with my back hurting to this. I can take an achy back. I can take an achy head. I can do all of those things. I have a very high tolerance for pain. I gave birth to four children with not even a shot of Novocaine, for God's sakes. I am not afraid of some pain. But this was, you know, this was taking away any quality of life that I had. So I made the decision. Yes, I made the decision because I liked this doctor. I trusted him. I sat with him 2 weeks before the surgery, and I said, his name was Dr. Abrams. I said, "Dr. Abrams, everybody's telling me I make a mistake, you know, that back surgery is dangerous. I could end up crippled." He said, "Honey, you're crippled now." He said, I promise you. I can't promise you that it will always stay okay because you got a lot of damage back there. I'm going to fix two things, but I'm telling you, I can make you feel better than you do right now." So I trusted him. I went into the operating room. I have never been sorry that I did that, not ever. But those decisions I had to make on my own and make the best choices that I could make. And that's what people have to do. And that's the same thing you have to do with your children. You have to talk to your child. If your child is misbehaving in school and a doctor or a teacher or somebody is driving you crazy and trying to get you to put your child on some kind of, I know there's something other than Ritalin they use, and I couldn't find the word today in all the stuff I looked at. They used other terminology, so I didn't see the word that I recognize, but there's several different kinds of things now that they give to young people. And if you're really concerned about your child's behavior, address what kind of food you feed them, talk to them, find out what they're thinking, what's going on in their head, talk to them about being more, you know, concentrate a little bit on their behavior so people see them for who they really are and love them the way you do. And see if that doesn't put them to a better place. If you do need some help, try to make other decisions to help your child before you just automatically give them a pill to pop. Because once you pop the first pill, then that's the road you're on. And
right.
I don't think that's where any of you want to be. But I do know that in some cases, like I said earlier, I know some parents that swear that their children are better when they're under the jurisdiction of a psychiatrist or a psychologist and are taking something to keep them a little bit more grounded. But again, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that will do the same thing without any of those side effects. So,
Right.
we're gonna talk some more about this. This is a really, really, really big topic.
Yes, it is.
And when I opened up, I mean, there's, as you click through it, there's like six or seven different sites that give you all kinds of. I was shocked that the first one I opened was about Hitler. And they actually blame a lot of that carnage on doctors talking about mental illness and who's right and who's not right and things like that. So, of course, that makes perfect sense, too much sense for my liking. But and in today's world, you know, the things that you, there's something going on right here in Florida right now, a man left the house, burnt down. There's a body in the house, and he's got a teenager and a little boy with him, and they think he's got the vehicle that they're in rigged to blow up if they stop him. Now, you're talking about somebody there who's, you know, a few cards short, so something is going on. But on that note, when we talk about doctors, I want to tell you about the nurse that goes into the doctor's office and says, doctor, there's a man out here who needs to see you. He thinks he's invisible. And the doctor looks at her and says, tell him I can't see him. Funny,
good.
Huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Very good.
Yeah, I thought it was cute. So, we'll sign off now. We're down to just a couple seconds. Thanks, Shell, for finding me this topic. I really enjoyed the research I did today, and we will continue talking about this because I think it's something that affects a lot of different people. But
yes,
for the time being, we're going to take the weekend off. I'll be back Monday. I will not be here Tuesday. I'm hoping to be back Wednesday, but that's not a sure thing yet. And again, please keep the prayers and positive energy coming for my kid. He will be 44 in October. And this is a really rough operation that he's having, so I appreciate everybody's love and support in regard to that. So from my heart to yours, everybody, this is Renee. Good night, and God bless. Good night, Shelly Belly.
Good night, Renee, and you and your family are always in my prayers.
I know, honey bunch, I know. All right, I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, good night.